partly, but also because I see no substantiation as I look around, as the evidence of my senses and my studies show, I find no supporting evidence for any belief in any theory. Sorry.
Hey, Dr. Montgomery. In your first presentation, you seem to be suggesting at one point that one reason for believing in God is that to reject belief in God entails, I seem to be hearing you say this, entails the absence of any firm foundation for moral value. And you gave Nietzsche as an example.
No. I very carefully distinguish, I hope, between indicating the importance of the question and the evidence. The fact that we would be up the ethical and metaphysical creek without a paddle if there is not a God is, of course, not evidence that there is a God.
Okay. All right. Do you think that we would be up the ethical creek if there were no God, that Nietzsche's position would be the only alternative?
No, it's not the only alternative, but it's not possible logically to exclude it. And the fact that we cannot exclude it puts us in a very, very awkward position under those circumstances.
All right. I'll accept that for the moment. The floor is now open to questions, and if we maintain good order in this, I don't see any reason why we can't ask these questions directly to the speaker of your choice. Yes, right here.
I have a question for Dr. Montgomery.
Maybe you should stand up and speak loudly.
Yes, sir, I can repeat the question.
Okay.
Let me do that.
Okay. Obviously, Mr. Livingston finds something inherently wrong in believing that there can be a virgin birth, if I understood him correctly. Is there any reason to believe that a priori there can be no miracles take place? David Hume strove to prove such a thing. Can I have any philosophical doubt or belief, either the way, that miracles can or can't happen before I look at the evidence for them happening?
The question has to do with miracles. The questioner derived from what Mr. Livingston said that Mr. Livingston feels uncomfortable with the whole idea of a virgin birth or presumably other miracles. And is there any way a priori, that is ahead of checking out such questions, to determine whether or not miracles occur or not? David Hume, who was mentioned by the questioner, thought that it would be possible to provide some kind of philosophical edge, making it possible to determine miracles questions apart from the actual evaluation of the evidence. That particular position is definitely wrong. It's been refuted again and again. Unfortunately, David Hume engaged in a perfectly circular argument in reference to the miraculous. The only way you can possibly determine whether there's a uniform experience against the miraculous, which is the character of Hume's argument, is to check out alleged miracle claims. Only by determining whether or not there is sufficient evidence in any given instance can you determine whether the event took place or didn't take place. I'm certainly not suggesting that one should go around naively accepting the miraculous, but at the same time I'm saying that it's intellectually dishonest to rule out miracles without checking the particular evidence for them. It's all a question of data. And again, we need to do that checking ourselves.
Gentleman in the gray sweater.
It seems that during the debate, two key issues were kind of overlooked by the two guests. One question for Dr. Livingston that I would have would be, what is your opinion in relationship to the resurrection account? What is your opinion happened in relationship to that? And then after that, how do you explain the changed lives of the disciples? And then for Dr. Montgomery, Dr. Livingston brought up several Bible difficulties, sticky issues from the Old and the New Testament that seemingly were overlooked.
How would I explain the resurrection? Well, even nowadays, when we have very marvelous scientific ways to determine a person's death. We discover that every so often someone is declared dead. No heart, no brain activity, and so they're shipped off to the undertaker. And by golly, sometimes they revive. I have seen in a catacomb the remains of a woman who had been buried alive. Of course, everyone thought she was dead. So it's possible that someone who looks pretty dead, definitely dead, could be wrapped up in a sheet and put in a cave, and a stone put in front of the cave, and thought dead and turn out not to be dead. That's one possibility. Another is that some of his followers would come along and move the stone, cart the body away, and say he had been resurrected. Personally, I just don't give much credence to miracles. Miracles are simply things that are supposed to violate all the laws of the universe. And so far, I haven't seen any. That doesn't mean, I suppose, Dr. Montgomery would say that they couldn't occur. But
that's a very important point.
Yeah, well, I don't see the point in a God creating a universe with laws just so he can go around violating them whenever he wants.
Since this was a question directed to both of us, maybe I could dialogue a little bit with you on that. Just out of curiosity, how do you know what these absolute laws are that the that God supposedly worked into the universe at the beginning, or not believing in God, that are present in the universe and that never are violated? How do you know those laws?
Well, if you say that we don't know the laws, then therefore it's no miracle if something in contradiction to the law occurs.
Well,
or if it isn't a valid law,
or we're putting
if something happens, then it's no miracle because it wasn't a law in the first place.
Yeah, or putting it more precisely, it isn't a miracle in the way you just define miracles. But of course, that isn't the way that I would define miracles anyway. A miracle is not a violation of an absolute law, a knowledge of which we had ahead of time. A miracle turns out to be a unique event of overwhelming significance. Okay?
Well,
and the significance, well, the point is that we're not concerned primarily with defining it. We're concerned with whether it occurs. I don't care how resurrection is defined in terms of the use of the term miracle. What I care is whether or not the thing happened. Because if death was indeed conquered under those conditions, then I want to pay very close attention to the fellow who did that, especially when he says, "I am the resurrection, the life, and he who believes in me shall never die," because that could have a real influence on my situation.
Well, that thought may influence you, and as you say, faith does influence you. To me, faith in things like that is merely a lullaby to put the brain to sleep.
On the matter of alleged biblical difficulties, alleged biblical contradictions, biblical difficulties and the like, I didn't want to take each of those instances that Mr. Levingston cited. There are many others that could be cited. They've been known throughout the centuries. Many of them were dealt with fairly effectively in the 5th century in the correspondence between Augustine and St. Jerome. The Reformers did a lot with them. I'll just refer Mr. Levingston and all of you to a couple of works on the subject. This is the classic by John Haley entitled Alleged Discrepancies of the Bible. There are many more than Mr. Levingston knows, I'll betcha, set forth here, and fairly well answered. And there is a recent work by Dr. Gleason Archer, PhD in Old Testament from Harvard. The work is entitled Biblical Encyclopedia of Biblical Difficulties. Came out just last year. You can look up all of those instances that Mr. Levingston cited and see if you feel that the resolutions are satisfactory.
Has the gentleman with the pen in his hand?
I see that there's no God. This is right to Dr. Mason. By saying that there's no God, it means everything's relative to the culture we live in. Given the situation, whereas a 4 year it's more about miserable life.
Well, basically what's been asked is how can you have a morality without a God? Yes, he wants to know how we can have a morality if we don't have a God. In other words, he says that everything would be a relative morality. And this is a question that's often asked. How can we have morality without God? My answer to that would be that morality is a survival technique. If we watch movies of how animals hunt, wolves, lions, whatever, they don't race each other to be the first to capture the prey and tear it apart. They cooperate so that they're more certain that they will get a meal. In other words, the actions of each are in cooperation with the others for the benefit of all of them. And people are obviously smart enough to see that that is so. I mean, you may drive home in a hurry from here along dark streets with very little traffic. Perhaps there's a reason why you're rushing to get home, or maybe you're rushing to see a young man or a young lady, and you may miss her or him. And so you're very anxious, and you know there are not many police cars around. Perhaps you've never seen any on that stretch, and so you could go through a red light. Now you've got a moral question. Should you do it, or should you take a chance that somebody else is going through the green light in the other direction? We can have a morality that deals with that. Every day we're faced with moral decisions, and we don't need a God to tell us whether we should beat up a four-year-old child.
Yes, right there. The gentleman is turning around to see what I'm talking about.
I thought you said this. I have serious problems with your contingency argument. One, if we define the universe as infinite and all encompassing, how could it be contingent? Because it has to be contingent upon something outside of it. That contradicts the first statement, which is that it's infinite and all encompassing. And if the universe is contingent, if I submit that the universe is contingent, there's no way that you can suppose that there's a universe. The conclusion that God did it doesn't necessarily follow. It only means that something started in the universe. I don't see how you can conclude from the contingency argument that God exists. And if the contingency argument you espoused is valid, then you come to the who created God, a super God, and then a super God created that super God and created that. So I don't think your argument is at all persuasive.
Well, in the first place, I guess I should repeat the question, right?
Yeah.
The question has to do with the legitimacy of the contingency argument. Let's see. First of all, the definition of contingency the universe is dependent seems to contradict the idea of its infinitude, and therefore one cannot use this term effectively. Argument, after all, only takes you to the idea that the universe started. It doesn't take you to a God necessarily. And then finally, it doesn't provide any kind of basis for theism as such. Is that fair enough as a paraphrase?
Yeah, but you have to separate the two. It's not one argument. The first one is the second. Deal with the second one.
And who created God?
Oh, yes, and then the infinite regress. Yes, okay. Well, in the first place, contingency only means lack of self-explanation in this argument. It doesn't presuppose the infinity or non-infinity of the universe. It's simply an inductive argument beginning with the nature of phenomena. Whether or not they are capable of explaining themselves, it moves on to a fairly obvious proposition that the universe is the sum total of all the stuff in it, and arrives at the particular conclusion. The infinite regress bit, unfortunately, is not a sound counter to this argument. Why? Because if you start with a universe consisting apparently of stuff that does not explain itself, you can either absolutize that universe as the atheist does and say that's all there is, or you move on to a source of it outside of it. Okay? Now that, in the contingency argument, is what we mean by God. You're perfectly right. It doesn't go beyond that. You don't arrive at the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that way. But it is a starting point. One needs to move in the direction, it seems to me, that we indicated previously. You've got to get down to the case as to whether God revealed himself so as to tell you what he is like. You're not going to find out what he's like from that argument. The trouble with the infinite regress thing is this, that if you don't stop with an infinite non-contingent source of the universe, then, of course, you're going to have to go to, as you suggest, a God of the second power to explain the God of the first power. Then you'll have to go to a God of the third power to explain a God of the second power. You'll move on until you finally reach God to the nth power. In other words, the series is infinite. And if it's infinite, you haven't explained God to the n minus one, right? Nor, obviously then, if you explain God to the n minus two, and the series works itself back, and you end up right where you started, you have not provided any explanation for the contingent universe you began with. So you've used up a tremendous amount of energy for nothing. You might as well either stop with the bloomin' universe you're in right now, or simply move to an infinite explanation of it. Those are really the only two ways to go. I've suggested that it is irrational to stop with the universe you're in, because if you do that, you really absolutize a universe in which not a single thing in it can be regarded as absolute.
This is directed to Dr. Montgomery. There's been literally millions of people that have thrived on the earth, born, lived, and died on the earth, that have never seen a Bible, heard of a Bible. They have conjured up their own culture. They have made their own gods. They have sacrifices such as the American Indian. Now, these people, they grew up and died. Now, when they die, how does he judge them if there is a God? How does he judge them? How does he judge them on their way of life, and how does he judge if they go to heaven or to hell? And then, how do I, in this day and age, look at my environment and judge to accept Jesus Christ? And if I do, how do I know that is the way? And the way I believe, how do I know that I can't get to heaven in the way I believe? And then, secondly, to somebody who absolutely thinks it is appalling to believe in atheism, and this is directed to Mr. Livingston, someone who thinks it's absolutely appalling to believe in atheism, and some people think that there's no other way to believe than God, how do you direct those questions to that? And the first one to Mr. Montgomery, what happens to people who die who haven't received Jesus Christ? How does he judge them? God.
All I know about the way God deals with people, I find in his revelation. I mean, I don't have any independent pipeline to the mind of God. All I know about God, he has given to me and to everybody else by way of his revelation of himself. And either it's possible to justify that revelation or not. If it is possible to justify it, then I can go with those data. If the revelation can't be justified, I don't even have that information. Now, the Bible doesn't go into the question of what happens to people who are outside of any contact with Christian faith. We can infer from general principles in the Bible various things. For example, Jesus weeps over the city of Jerusalem, and he says, "How often I would have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks, but you would not." The implication is clear there that Jesus would do everything in his power to bring those people into a right relationship with himself and with the Father, but he will not violate their free will. I take it from that not a single person will ever be lost who could possibly have been saved, but God will not run roughshod over the human will. It says in also in the Bible, Jesus speaking, "Behold, I stand at the door of your heart. I stand at the door and knock. If any man will open the door, I will come into him and sup with him, and he with me." But you don't find Jesus battering down the door of a human heart. And it seems to me that's vitally important. We don't have to be able to solve every last cosmic question in order to make a decision as to the truth of Christianity. As that passage from the Venerable Bede nicely indicated at the outset, if any light is shed on the nature of this dark world through the appearance of God in Jesus Christ, that's enough to move in that direction. There are probably excellent seminars on this subject that will be given during the millennium. You know, you can sign up at the registration desk.
I frankly have lost the part of the question directed to me. Do you want to repeat that?
There's many people who believe that it is appalling to be an atheist. And I want you to address them to say why you're an atheist and why it is not appalling.
I'm an atheist because I find it unthinkable, as far as I'm concerned, that there would be such a thing as a God. That's all. As you notice, there are many gods you don't believe in. I believe in one less than you do. That's why I'm an atheist. As far as finding out, as far as ultimate knowledge about anything, I can stand not knowing many things. As many scientists can. I heard Richard Feynman, the great physicist at Caltech, say that it didn't bother him not to know everything, and it really doesn't bother me a great deal.
And I want to add to this. Now, can we, okay, what about to the person who, right now, who dies? What is he coming? How do they get, how does God judge them? People who don't believe in Jesus Christ. I mean, they must go somewhere, right? They have to go to heaven or hell. Seriously, they must go somewhere. So he must make a judgment on the facts that are before him, even though they have not accepted Jesus Christ.
Okay, he must short answer to this, as best I can. I don't want to get preachy on this, but you almost force me into it. We've had some statements made tonight by Mr. Levingston about the torturing God of the Bible and how he will even go to the point of maltreating people in eternity because of trivial questions of belief here on earth. The picture that you get in the Bible is really not that. The conception of eternity that many people have comes more from Dante than it does from the Bible. I guess I'd refer you to help on this to an image in one of C.S. Lewis' works. He pictures hell as a train station. And people arrive at the train station, and already in the train, they are arguing with each other, and the essence of their argument is, we're better than the people in the next car, we're better than the people across the aisle from us. And the train disgorges these people out onto a platform, and they begin to form small groups. And in each of these groups, the idea is, we're better than the other people. And the landscape of hell consists of people moving out from the train station platform, forming cities, but of course they break up, and smaller little units of people move out toward the horizon. And finally, in the far distance, you see the end product of all of this. Each person isolated, saying to himself in his little hovel, well, I showed them, the Bible presents hell as the ultimate result of selfishness. And selfishness is cosmically manifested when a person comes across the God who loved him so much, the died for him, and the person is unwilling to face that and unwilling to allow that God to move to the center of the stage, but insists upon his own selfishness at the center of the whole thing. If a person persists in that view of things, he gets in the next life exactly what he has already created for himself in this life, namely a universe that focuses on himself. And hell is simply a universe focused on you or on me. And the short answer to your question is, therefore, that it behooves each of us to make a decision as to who we want at the center of our lives. And eternity is going to be consequential on that decision.
May I say something on that? I'm not really a Bible scholar. We have some in our organization. Some have written books on the Bible. But I've listened to many fundamentalist preachers who proclaim the inerrancy of the Bible. In other words, word for word, it is true. This is not evidence in the court about people who saw an accident, by the way. It's people who are repeating the word of God. And therefore, there cannot be two different versions of that. Otherwise, God speaks with a forked tongue. But to get to this long story about the train stations and so on, I really don't see the relevance of that at all, if I may say. I heard a preacher the other night on television talking to a throng of many thousands and saying that the Bible says that those who believe in me shall come to heaven, and those who don't believe in me will go to hell. And he pointed out that there were millions, hundreds of millions of Christians who kneeled, and he kneeled and showed how they took the Eucharist and how they performed good works, and they did believe in God, but they weren't going to go to heaven because they were relying on other things than just their faith that Jesus was God. And so I can only say what I hear ministers and others who believe in the inerrancy of the Bible say, that the answer is, if you believe, you go to heaven, and if you come to believe 1 second before you die, you've made that train to heaven. And if you miss it by 1 second, down the hill.
I'd like to get some more questions from the floor now. The gentleman in the red shirt has had his hand up for the last 15 minutes.
You gave a quick synopsis of why you refuse the resurrection, and you gave an illustration that many people swoon, or many people have their hearts have stopped and their brainwaves have stopped, they have come back. But how many of those people were marred to the point where they looked like hamburger? How many of those people had enough strength to push over a 2-ton stone open, even with a few friends helping them, that was on upward inclination? My question then is, how do you justify your short answer of the validity of the resurrection by stating some people that might have died and come back within 30 minutes or a couple hours, you know, they might have swooned. It just doesn't matter with his own physical body. It was not injured. And I'd also like to make a statement. My main question is directed on the resurrection. How do you give this quick justification when modern medical students who have studied what scriptures say about the impossible appears to be blood, water, and blood, which can only happen when the heart explodes or when the blood separates within the body? How would a person in that position be able to move a stone and a few of his friends with the Roman guards around? I mean, I think it would be great.
Well, that's a long question, I may say, and I do like to give short answers, and I guess my answer will be short. Anybody who's believed in Hinduism, who's been a witch, who's been a warlock and everything else, should have no difficulty in believing in what he believes in.
You realize that that's classic ad hominem.
John?
only argument question in one thing, and that is faith. If you're both watching...
I have them.
No, he was boiling. I wasn't boiling.
You believe that man has to believe?
No, I don't feel faith is the critical issue. I feel evidence is the critical issue. The fact is that everybody utilizes faith in ordinary life. Faith jumps the gap between evidence and a conviction. All right? But you never have 100% evidence for any matter of fact. When you cross the street, you look both ways, 80% chance of getting across, going down every year. And when you take yourself across, you normally take 100% of yourself. You don't leave 20% on one side. The difference between the 80 and the 100 is faith. And I'm only asking people to check out the evidence for the resurrection of Christ, for the incarnation, as we've been talking about it tonight, and then to see if it is the same kind of decision that they make in ordinary life to jump the gap from that probability or plausibility evidence to a conviction. Okay? I'm not using this in the same way as Mr. Levinson. He seems to think that the Christians are sort of woolly-minded people who believe. They believe. Yippee!
I would like to respond to the at-home charge. I didn't mean to imply some slur against that young man, but the fact is that obviously he thought he had good reason to be a Hindu, and he thought he had good reason to be a witch, and he thought he had good reasons to be a warlock, and the fact that he now thinks he has good reason to be a Christian, I just don't find very persuasive in itself as evidence. Go ahead.
Brad? I do remember your name.
Still not answering the question of the resurrection.
The resurrection we had posed as somebody who was hamburger. Now, you know, that's pretty extreme. And actually, we don't know. All we've got are pictures that first, or statues, sculptures that first started to come out long afterwards. And I don't find any special validity in that. I'm sorry.
Do you want a brief follow-up to make your question more specific, Trenton?
Yeah, I don't see when Dr. Montgomery went to the historian Josephus and how he described exactly how crucifixion looks like. I don't see that on a wall. I see that
Josephus is the only person, and this was a world where news traveled pretty fast and far, and people were interested in all kinds of things, and his is the only mention outside of the disciples, so-called, and we don't even have a record of theirs that is verifiable, that mentions anything about Jesus. And I don't find any great reason to believe in that little snatch of his.
Gentleman standing next to Sean.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a long time, but I've read the Old and New Testaments. I don't find it very fascinating or believable reading.
Nevertheless,
go ahead.
You have not taken the time to educate yourself in God. You have not taken the time. You have not become intelligent enough about God.
Specific subjects. The word atheist merely means without God. That's all. It doesn't say anything about our beliefs on other subjects.
Evolution?
Pardon?
evolution? Would you believe in evolution?
I think that the evidence for evolution is pretty strong, yes.
It is tonight.
Ah, we have creationists here. Good.
Better than the evidence.
This is not a symposium on creationism. Gentleman back there with the glasses?
You said religion have to control all things, right?
Pardon?
You said religion have to control all things.
Control
the fear. Oh. It's an attempt to control the things we're afraid of.
My question is, I can see how that fits well with Hindu, Krishna, but practically, the way he expressed Christianity, the God of Christianity, was that he's atrocious. He has done horrible things. Why would I, in my right mind, want to seek to create such a God or whatever? I would see myself creating a God who is a little bit more compromised, if not so evil. Why would I want to? Why not all these people created a God who is so atrocious?
I guess they would have to answer that question themselves. I can't tell you why other people are creating whatever they create. As far as religion controlling anything, the idea is that religion is designed to control people, to control their minds. There was a time when Christianity ruled the Western world. That time is known as the Dark Ages.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. And in our century, we have managed, under the tutelage of modern secularism, to kill more of our fellow human beings than in all of the wars of human history. We have actually created worse devastation in the 20th century than in all of the past centuries in which we live. I'm a little bit bothered by this kind of lay psychoanalysis that religious people are religious because they're scared. That kind of argument, unfortunately, is two-edged. There's a very interesting little book, Mr. Levingston, that you ought to get a hold of. It's by R.C. Sproul. It's entitled The Psychology of Atheism. And what Sproul does there is to try to analyze what could possibly bring a person to such a position in light of the evidence that does exist for God. In other words, there apparently has to be some overwhelming psychological reason for anybody to arrive at that kind of position. Now, I don't think that sort of argumentation is terribly fruitful, but I want to point out to you that it is a two-edged sword. If you start playing Papa Freud on the Christians, it's possible to swing that around, and there may be psychological reasons why you've arrived at the particular beliefs you have. Certainly, they're not on the basis of a careful examination of the New Testament.
First of all, I haven't arrived at my conclusions about some of the reasons why people believe in religion. I haven't psychoanalyzed anybody. I just pointed out that that's a major reason and observing what people try to do with religion. What is prayer but an appeal to a judge to grant the appellant a repeal of the laws of the universe in favor of the appellant, who's admittedly a sinner. So, what can I say about psychoanalyzing? I'm not psychoanalyzing anybody. I'm just pointing out that there are reasons, and there may be different reasons why different people become atheists.
I'm going to cut this off at 10 o'clock sharp, unless I get some direction to the contrary from this gentleman here. The gentleman holding up the piece of paper there? Yes.
Mr. Livingston, I used to be an atheist, and I am not anymore.
Good deal.
I can rephrase a little bit at this point. I'm not valid at this point, but it seems that trying to prove that evidence of at least their temple-like deity to reveal himself to us, whereas you really don't see it emotionally, don't have anything for any evidence. The only natural lack of evidence, if there was one, he would show himself. If there was one, he wouldn't show himself. He has evidence. Where's your lack of evidence?
But many gods have tried to give evidence that they've showed themselves, and hundreds of millions of people have believed that evidence. We don't believe it anymore. I think the time will come when we won't accept this evidence either.
Yes, the gentleman here.
My question is to Mr. Livingstone. You told that you read the Bible and you didn't believe it. I read it and I believed it. And if you pick two persons on the street, just ordinary persons, and you set them up two separate rooms, give them pencil and paper and one controversial subject, let's say in this case God, because many people have different opinions, are they able to write down all the ideas that come to their minds concerning God? When you compare the notes, there would be definitely contradictions. One would think this, one would think that. My question is here. The Bible claimed to be written about the period of 1600 years, the Old and the New Testament to completion. And there is 40 men, they all testified that they had an encounter with an eternal being called God. Thus said the Lord, the word of the Lord came, so forth. And there was hundreds of controversial subjects. And I asked this many atheists and agnostics, and I had no satisfactory answer. But how is it possible that the Bible, in perfect harmony, the New Testament is the fulfillment of the Old Testament? And I don't know if you... And the second question I have is that, did you ever ask God that if he was... If you would say, well, I don't know if you're for real, but I'd like to know if...
In answer to that, I must say that all through this evening we've been talking about the Bible. I recently went down to a large public library and opened the drawer to the index file that said Bible. There are hundreds of Bibles, and there are many Christian faiths, and the Catholics do not have the same Bible as the Protestants. We're not talking about a single book. They don't even have the same Ten Commandments in the same order. So when people say they read the Bible and that it's always the same, maybe they're reading the same Bible over and over and it's always the same. As far, by the way, as the contention that in this secular century we have killed more people than ever before in history. At this moment, there are more people alive than have ever lived in all of recorded time, so that any single little war is likely to kill more people than a lot of wars beforehand. But in the name of God, millions of people have been killed. Why are Protestants and Catholics slaughtering each other in Ireland? Why are Sunni and Shiite Muslims slaughtering each other in Iran and Iraq? They all believe in God, but just a slightly different version, and that's enough to kill people over.
Response?
Yes, the woman right there would be speaker.
As for all the killing, neither was ever excommunicated, neither was Dr. Mingle, neither was Heinrich Himmler, neither were most of the leaders in the Third Reich. And Bishop Quisling, the Protestant fanatic, was the Minister of Defense in Norway, and he sabotaged his country and damaged the Nazis in 2 days. I want to ask this very intelligent man up here.
Okay, this very intelligent man would like to say something to what you just said. Are you possibly implying by that statement that Hitler, Himmler, and company were in fact believing Christians? The mere fact that they weren't excommunicated doesn't cut any ice. That simply means that there was an inefficient church administration. Have you read Eichmann? Hahn's testimony when he was interrogated in Israel. This has just been translated from Hebrew into English, published in England. He explains there how he was a church person when he was a child, and he came to the conclusion that there was no God in any Christian sense of the term. He describes his theological position, or his lack of a theological position, and ties this right in to the way in which he treated the Jewish people at the death camps. That's the history of the extermination of 6 million Jews. The people who did that were unbelievers, madam, and you better realize it.
American Christian. Now, we're seated in a hall that's lighted by electricity, which used to be called a miracle. Did you know that Thomas Alva Edison developed his intellect? He was a self-sufficient human being, and he was an atheist. And he said the same thing that Karl Marx said across on the other side of the world. We scold Karl Marx for saying that religion is the opium of the people. You young people should know that Thomas Alva Edison presented this, one of the biggest things in the technological world. You know what he said? Religion is bunk. Now, this man up here doesn't tell you that the electron microscope is far more revealing to a young mind than any divinity up here. And I advise you, if you are attending a college here, and you should pay attention not to the work of men who lived long before the circulation of the blood was discovered, long before it was known that semen generated life in the ovum. You're a man who's supposed to be educated.
I know what people have known about semen for quite some time.
In the time of him and Abe, long after Jesus.
Oh, he knew about semen. There's no question about it.
Henry VIII, in his day, they didn't know that it was the male who determined the sex of the child. Did you know this?
Do you have a question for Dr. Montgomery? Maybe we need to impose some order on us. Do you have a question?
He hasn't answered any questions.
Answer. It's easy.
Is there a particular question you would like him to answer?
Yeah, I ask him, why is he comfortable living in a world where evolution has created a system which achieves the aspect of purpose without the intervention of a purposer? Why is he so uncomfortable? I'm an atheist, and I find it very comfortable to live in such a system. And I don't want this audience to be so hostile. I find you all here determined to convert every atheist. In no way does an atheist...
Wait, what is your question for Dr. Montgomery?
Why is he so uncomfortable?
I'm not uncomfortable. I feel just fine.
I have one observation to make about the joke about semen. We must remember that in the Bible, Onan, who spilled his semen on the ground, was killed for it. That's a final punishment.
No comment. No comment.
Can we hear one question out? He was cut in this sentence. He has never heard.
Whose question is that?
My son.
Okay, you may end the evening, Sean.
My question, please, I beg you. No matter how you both respond to the fact that I would say it's certainly great that I see an atheist on one side, I see a Christian on the other side, no one knows it. It bothers me greatly to see right here. Yes, you do interpret facts, but in fact, you interpret your facts in your direction. And you, sir, you say that it's an atheist. You appear the exact same as the Christian demands that you know this other world. You say to me that it doesn't exist. My point is this. Can you truly say that besides faith, if there is any absolute proof of either one of the points? That's all I ask.
Want to answer first? Go ahead.
I'm the dean of a law school named for a gentleman by the name of Simon Greenleaf. Greenleaf was professor of evidence at the Harvard Law School in the 19th century. He was the greatest common law authority on evidence in the 19th century. His textbook on the subject was used in England as well as in the States. And Greenlee also did a little work entitled The Testimony of the Evangelists. He put, as it were, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John on the witness stand to see if their testimony to Jesus Christ would hold up in a common law court. And in that work, he says this, and it speaks right to what you're saying. Quote, all that Christianity asks of men on this subject is that they would be consistent with themselves, that they would treat its evidences as they treat the evidence of other things, and that they would try and judge its actors and witnesses as they deal with their fellow men when testifying to human actions in human tribunals. Let the witnesses be compared with themselves, with each other, and with surrounding facts and circumstances, and let their testimony be sifted as if it were given in a court of justice on the side of the adverse party, the witness being subjected to a rigorous cross-examination. The result, it is confidently believed, will be an undoubting conviction of their integrity, ability, and truth. Now, what Greenleaf is saying there is not that we can demand absolute evidence for any matter of fact in this world, but there are standards by which we judge evidence, standards of probability and plausibility, the kinds of standards that operate in courts of law. And all I'm asking is that you consider the evidence for the appearance of God in Jesus Christ as you would consider evidence for those things that you accept as a matter of course. The evidence will not rise to 100%, but it will be a sufficient ground for commitment.
I think that what Dr. Montgomery has read to us shows that there is good reason why every defendant is entitled to his own defense attorney in American courts, and must have a defense attorney. For you have an attorney who is presenting the evidence both for and against. You're going to have a one-sided case, and that's what you have in that book. There was no other attorney in the case to question the witnesses. Naturally, they were asked the right questions. As far as your question about an atheist who's on the other side, it's often charged that we have a purely negative position. To an extent, that's true. We're in the same position as the abolitionists in the last century. They had a negative position. They were against slavery. We are against slavery of the mind. We refuse to believe anything which our reason, which is the only thing we have to go on, it convinces us. Thank you.
Wants to put one more question to one of our speakers. I suppose that is his prerogative. After the speaker has answered the question, we can conclude with a round of applause for our speakers, and things will have finished.
In light of the recent uprising of the moral majority, how do you perceive the moral majority and how it interacts with our society and how it makes decisions in our government for the majority of the people?
Well, I think they're the best argument there is for keeping church and state separate. Because when you mix together, he had the last question.
I didn't hear his question.
Oh, sorry. How do I reply to the situation we have now where the moral majority, so-called, is involved in the affairs of government? And I have appeared following Jerry Falwell on the TV interview show and have heard him immediately thereafter on a radio show in which he repeated word for word what he had said on the TV show, and in both appearances of which he acted as a surrogate for Ronald Reagan, explaining why the policies of Reagan were correct. Now, the danger of mixing religion and government is this, that you then cannot debate political questions on the basis of the facts, because you are then
disputing their religion. If you debate religion or argue against a religious point, it means you're unpatriotic because you're against the government. Where religion and government have mixed, it's been a total disaster for the people. And that's why you often hear that our forebears came to this country to escape religious persecution. It's true. Who was persecuting them? Were they other religions? Muslims, Jews, atheists? No, they were being persecuted by other Christians. And they came here to seek freedom for their religious beliefs. And what did they do when they got here? They immediately exercised the freedom of their religion and suppressed everybody else's religion. In 11 out of the 13 colonies, there were laws against people of other religions. They taxed people who did not believe in the established church of the colony to support that church. In Massachusetts, a Catholic who was caught the second time was sentenced to death. In 1660, Mary Dyer, a Quaker, was hanged on Boston Common for preaching the Quaker Creed. That's what you get when you mix religion and government. And if any of you think that you happen to be in the majority group which will run the government, don't be so sure. Thank you.
May I comment?
Yeah.
Yes, it's nice after an evening of conflict on a tremendous number of points to be able to express agreement at the very end. I certainly feel, as you do, that the mixing of religion and the state is a very, very dangerous affair. We are fortunate to be living in a country where there is a separation of church and state, where there is a state church. Invariably, this hurts both the church and the state. So I really couldn't agree more with that sentiment. At the same time, the question, I think, is a bit deeper than just that, because, of course, our Constitution guarantees, by way of the First Amendment, the separation of church and state. One can misunderstand this to mean that it is not legitimate for citizens to apply their religious beliefs in the political arena. If we were to arrive at that conclusion, then of course we would be violating the First Amendment in not permitting people to carry out the natural implications of their belief. Let me contrast our situation with that in the Soviet Union. If you look at the Soviet Constitution, you see that it guarantees freedom of religious belief and freedom for atheistic propaganda. Now, the wording is very careful. You can believe anything you want to in Russia. There's no problem with that. But just try to express it by attempting to influence the government toward a more ethical or moral policy. For example, just try to get the Russian government to pay attention to the Helsinki Final Act. And what happens? Well, you end up on a salt diet. That's what happens. And if you try to evangelize in the Soviet Union, you get into big trouble. You can believe anything you want, but you can't put it into action. I have the suspicion that many secularists in our country, when they talk about the separation of church and state, means something very different from the idea that there must not be an official state religion. What they really want to do is to say to religious believers, shut up, we don't want to hear from you. But you see, religious believers have to be citizens as well. And if they do believe heartily in human rights, in fundamental human values, and they see in situations like the abortion situation, areas where there needs to be a moral amelioration in our country, and they speak out on it, then suddenly they are supposed not to have any right to do that. Let's be very careful. The First Amendment is two-edged. The First Amendment says no official establishment of religion, but it also says that every religious believer has a right to express his beliefs in action. So both of those aspects of our Constitution are vital, and I'm very happy that we are able to hold both of them high.
Yes, I wish you had not brought the Russians in. It sort of imputes that somehow I might be in favor of their position.
No, 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 I didn't mean that at all. No.
Okay. I will say this, that nobody that I know who believes in separation of church and state believes that religious people should not have the right to express their beliefs. I believe they have the right to preach, to teach, to do all those things, to express what to them is their moral opinion. I say they have no right to impose their opinion as a religious opinion founded on religion on the rest of us.
Amen, brother. Yes, amen.
I'm glad that we have reached some small measure of harmony here.